uploading the virus.
Eagle One, the package is being delivered.
We grew up watching movies about the robot uprising. Science fiction warned us for decades that the robots were coming, and that they'd be smarter, stronger, and faster. Burn-In, a novel of the real robot revolution, is a book about the social upheaval that'll come when automation finally takes over. Set in the near future, Burn-In depicts a world where FBI agents work with robot partners, algorithms have replaced lawyers, and terrorists meet up inside a video game to discuss their next target. Burn-In looks like a light summer read, but it's filled with footnotes and references like a non-fiction book. Authors August Cole and P.W. Singer call this fic-int, and see it as a way to envision the future using both fiction and well-researched fact. Cole is a journalist who's covered the defense industry for everyone from NPR to the Wall Street Journal. Singer has worked for the Brookings Institute, the Barack Obama presidential campaign, and more Pentagon-connected think tanks than I can name. Fic-int is Cole and Singer's latest attempt to communicate the challenges of the future to both the general public and America's policymakers. Singer is with us today to talk about what it's like to write about the future when you have to cite your sources. I'm Matthew Galt, and this is Cyber. Peter Singer, thank you so much for coming onto the pod.
Oh, I appreciate you having me.
All right, so the book is Burn-In, a novel of the real robotic revolution. What is Burn-In about?
So Burn-In is a new kind of book. It's a smash-up of a novel and nonfiction. I know that sounds sort of different, and it is. So what it is it's a techno-thriller. You follow an FBI agent on the hunt for a terrorist through the streets of a future Washington, D.C., and you follow them to both familiar places, a Starbucks, the National Mall, a train station, but also to places that a lot of people don't get to go. For example, what is it really like inside the White House Situation Room? But through the story, there are actually over 300 explanations and predictions baked into it, replete with the nonfiction research end notes to show, hey, this is actually from the real world. So the concept of it is that you get, a vivid story, you meet some awesome characters, but you also learn about everything from how does AI work to what are the planned applications of it by the police, by the military, by restaurants, to what are some of the dilemmas that we're all going to be facing? What are the ripple effects that it's going to have on our politics, on our business, security, even on our family life? I've been joking that I'm a parent. It's a little bit like sneaking fruit and veggies into the smoothie. So for some people, it's, they just like the taste. For other people, it's got some good stuff in there for you.
Right. The experience of reading it is, it's like you're reading a fiction book, and then every once in a while, there's a little number, as if you're reading a nonfiction book, that gives you a reference in the back that links to an article, a YouTube video, a scientific article that explains one of the concepts that's appeared in the novel, right? Is kind of how it works.
Yeah. And the idea is that, for a lot of readers, they'll never go back to those references. They'll just go right through it and judge it by just, was it a thrilling read? Did they have fun? Did this character or this moment really speak to them? For other people, they'll see that number and go, and it might be just the impact of it on the fiction side. Whoa, hold it. That sounded really sci-fi. You mean that's real? Or it might be a moment. So it's not just a cool new technology. It might be a moment. Hold it. That really could happen. And then for other people, they'll put their nonfiction hat on. And besides getting the added thrill or chill of that really could happen, they may want to learn more about it. And so it gives them a way to find out more about it, just like you would with a regular nonfiction book. And for us, the idea of it came out of actually the impact that our last book had had. I've done a series of nonfiction books, on everything from cybersecurity, to a book looking at the rise of the very first private military companies, the Blackwaters of the world. But it was the book that August Cole, my co-author on this, that we did together called Ghost Fleet that came out several years back. It was a novel. It was a novel that imagined what a World War III might look like, what a war between the US and China might look like. And you know, we wrote it originally basically trying to give people the experience that we'd had as kids, you know, enjoying early Tom Clancy, reading Red Storm Rising in the back of my mom's station wagon on the way to summer beach vacation. You know, I'm dating myself by not just the book, but revealing, you know, that was when we didn't have to wear seatbelts. The point was, you know, we wrote it for people to, you know, enjoy, have that same kind of enjoyment that we had had. But it struck a chord, not just for Summer Beach Read, but it actually ended up having greater impact on the real world than my nonfiction books had had. So we were asked to brief its real world lessons everywhere from the White House Situation Room to the tank, which is the conference room that the Joint Chiefs meet in inside the Pentagon, to military units like 82nd Airborne, JSOC, the team that got bin Laden. The Navy even named a $3.6 billion program Ghost Fleet. And so we were struck by that and said, okay, can we do that kind of dual approach with this new book? We've got a story idea. We've got characters that we think are going to be really exciting, but can we also mix into it some issues that are important, some lessons that people are going to need, but do it in a way that isn't going to lose them? Kind of another way of thinking about it is no one ever said, man, this is such a great PowerPoint. You ought to read it too by the pool. No one ever said, you know, man, this academic white paper, wow, it kept me up late last night. I just couldn't put it down. You don't have that, but they do say that about novels. They do say that about, you know, this character. Man, I really loved him or I really hated them. I think about them. There's a writer who has described this as one of the powers that fiction has, is that it's like planting a seed inside someone's brain, so that what our concept is, you can get that, but isn't even better if the seed that's planted is pulled a little bit from the real world.
I will give us some of these reference points. I'm interested in what you and Cole were concerned about. The subtitle of the book is A Novel of the Real Robotic Revolution. So we're looking at, this is a book set in the future, but I would say it's like what, how far into the future would you say?
So this is one of the little tricks of the trade. We don't put a specific date on it because very quickly you would have people sort of pinging off of that and maybe losing people. And then you get the problem of, you know, Arthur C. Clarke's 2001. you know, it didn't happen in 2001. So but let's just say, let me put it a different way. The rule of doing this that we followed, and we call it useful fiction, is that it has to be set in the real world places. So real world locales in Washington, D.C. area, has to be pulled from the real world. As I mentioned, real world research. And that also means that there's no what we call vaporware. Any technology in it, no matter how crazy sci-fi it sounds, actually has to already exist in the real world or be at prototype stage in some lab somewhere. It also means real world humans and dilemmas in it. The different way of putting this, you know, the military people would describe this as a lesson from Clausewitz, that you have the fog of war, you have the friction. So yes, you've got your plans, you've got your cool new tech that you want to use, but there's a bad guy who might go after the vulnerability in that tech. And oh, by the way, going back to the real world side, the way they go after it has already been shown in the real world. It's already been done somewhere else or shown off at a hacker convention. So, you know, to the point, you can illustrate that in two different ways. It might be a certain, let's say, technology. And, you know, maybe it's just a detail in a scene. two characters are talking, and overhead a certain type of delivery drone flies by. We then will have a little number, as you mentioned, a little end note that if you want, you can go look at, and it'll show, hey, that's not what the authors dreamed up. Here's Amazon's patent for it. This is what Amazon's really going to implement in the coming years. Or it might be a bigger issue or concept. So an example of this is algorithmic bias, which is this, you know, pretty complex idea of how AIs can how AI can end up unintentionally delivering a biased outcome or recommendation because it's been trained poorly, because it has bad data.
Now, I would say that specifically kind of the biases of AI that are built in by the people that create them is one of the major themes of the book, and something that the plot kind of turns around, right?
Yeah, and so it's this issue that it affects or will soon affect literally everyone. And you know, one of the fun things about the book has been, as you and I are talking, it's not yet out. It's about a week away, but I've already been, you know, back to this idea of policy side, doing briefings on the real world lessons for it for groups that range from U.S. Air Force to tech executives to a group of lawyers, you name it. And each of them are starting to see this complex idea of algorithmic bias play out. You know, in the military, it's how does it affect your targeting? In banking, it's they had a case of they were using an AI to screen who should get loans or not. And the AI turned out to be racist. It was screening out African Americans. Now, no one told it to be racist, but it was this inadvertent outcome. So, you know, issues that it affects you as a driver. There's AI bias issues that affect your car. It affects education of your kids. You name it. It's a big, important issue. Going to be even more important. So, again, most people not going to read a study of it. The way we depict it is a scene in the book where the character, our FBI agent, is trying to pick a bad guy out of a crowd at a train station. Very quickly, you know, your mind can visualize this. And so you follow him through this kind of, you know, cool scene. And
there's a credible bomb threat.
Yeah,
At Union Station.
Yeah, there's a bomb threat at a train station. And they're trying to figure out, you know, where's the bomb? Who's the bad guy? You know, very quickly you can kind of feel your heart racing just a little bit more at that. You can put yourself in the position of, you know, trying to figure out of all these different faces in the crowd. But then we, through that scene, get to see everything from, you know, the tech that looms. Here's what face recognition software is going to be able to do. Here's what augmented reality advertisements are going to look like. But oh, by the way, here's the issues that you're going to be dealing with in that world. Everything from, you may have face recognition software. You're still going to have homeless and inequality. You also have the problem of info overload. So our characters getting all of this data, but how do they deal with it? And then also the concern of, is the data biased or not? So the point is, by the end of that scene, you know, hopefully you've gotten sort of a cool experience. You know, did they find the bad guy in the crowd? But you also walk away from it getting exposure to all of these concepts that, again, are going to apply whether you work in business, whether you work in the government, whether you're a parent. And so that's hopefully kind of the utility of the blend.
I think this scene is very important. It happens very early on. I'm going to spoil just a little bit of it.
Yeah, I deliberately chose that scene because I didn't want to plot spoil, all the other big stuff. It's one of the things when you talk with authors, you'll find they almost always just talk about the little beginning things in the book because they're that's the difference with nonfiction. You know, in nonfiction, you do the, you know, bottom line up front, whereas in fiction, right, you're like, I don't want to reveal.
But so Keegan, the FBI agent who's in Union Station, has AR goggles on, or AR glasses on, and is kind of, like you said, an information overload. And it is only when she sets those glasses aside and kind of cut, you know, pushes all the data out and is able to look at things without this information stream coming in, that she's able to identify the bad guy, right? So one of the themes of the book that I think is very interesting is there was, up until very recently, I think, this kind of push that more data, more technology, all of this stuff is going to save us. You know, robots and AI, all of these things are going to make life easier and better unequivocally. And what we found, obviously, is that it changes things. It creates different sets of problems, right? And I would say that one of the themes of the book is kind of negotiating our relationship with these technologies, and beginning to realize that they are not all created equally, and more importantly, not all distributed equally. Correct?
Yes. Oh man, you've pulled out so many of the key themes in it. It's really great to, you know, sort of hear that they resonated in that way, again, through the idea of a novel. So one is the fine line in the real world between our visions of technology utopia and dystopia, and how in many ways it sort of depends on where you are in society as to how you feel, whether it's a, you know, utopian or dystopian view. And I think we all kind of, you know, are experiencing that, whether it's, you know, the grand promises of Silicon Valley, and it's going to cause all this wonderful stuff. And it does, but it also leaves us with a little bit of a creep factor, right? And you know, whether we're talking about, let's use an example, face recognition software. Face recognition software is being deployed out by, you know, everything from the military to use for targeting, by police forces in pretty much every major city, to companies that range from retail stores to Kentucky Fried Chicken had a project looking at deploying face recognition. So, you know, it's going to cause, for some situations, greater security. It's going to be used to identify customers and ensure that the transaction's right, to steer you things that your data trail shows that you want. But oh, by the way, it also feels like, you know, Big Brother, in the case of Kentucky Fried Chicken, Big Colonel watching you, right? So one is this, you know, you're going to get the technology. It's coming in either case, but there's a fine line between the dystopian or the utopian views of it. That's for every technology. Another part of it that hits is, you mentioned that uneven distribution. And what's so cool about you saying that is that's, you know, a riff off of the sci-fi writer William Gibson's idea that, you know, the future is already here. It's just unevenly distributed. And so what we play with that out into this real world, in that you will have an uneven distribution of the technology. You will have some people with the latest new awesome gear, and you'll have other people with the earlier generation. You have uneven distribution in terms of the types of robotic systems that are going to be out there. So much of sci-fi, you know, talks about it as just like there's one type of robot. And instead, you know, you'll have everything from little teeny tiny ones to ones where the humans riding in the system, the way the driverless cars are playing out, where it's not doing everything on your own. You're still sitting behind the wheel. You're taking over sometimes when it's not. Then you'll have other ones that are working as maybe even a partner. And so that unevenness, you know, creates, again, I think more the real way that it's going to happen. It also shows how we have an unevenness of inequality. You'll have different income levels in the future. But then the final thing that comes out of it is that theme that you mentioned of really it's about navigating it all. And much of the question of navigating it is a question of what does that human machine relationship look like, whether it's for the police officer, whether it's for the parent, whether it's for the criminal, whether it's for the business, and how does that relationship affect the human in the part of it, which, you know, is a story that gets left out of, whether it's the consistent sci-fi idea of, you know, no, the robots are going to rise up and kill us all, or, you know, all the new economic plans for deploying these technologies in the real world.
Yeah, it's funny. Real is italicized in the subtitle, right? A novel of the real robotic revolution. And it's, I think, because this is a book that looks at machine learning and artificial intelligence and robots. And it is not just The Matrix or iRobot. It's more nuanced and strange. There's a social upheaval that is coming and is kind of, it is the beginnings of, and parts of are depicted in this novel, that I think are going to affect jobs that people aren't expecting. Just like we talk about Keegan's home life, the FBI agent. I think about her husband, who was a big shot. I can't remember. He was a lawyer, but I can't remember exactly.
He's a contract lawyer.
Contract lawyer.
Yeah.
In a job that essentially has now been obliterated by artificial intelligence.
Yeah. So it's funny, and it's part of the concept is, we're on the exact 100-year anniversary of the creation of the word robot. It was created for a play called RUR, and the word was taken from an older Czech word for servitude or serf. And the characters in that play, the robots, were mechanical servants that wise up and then rise up. And ever since, that idea of a robot revolt has cut through all of our science fiction. You know, you mentioned the Terminators and the Matrixes, and it's also affected kind of the way we think about it in the real world. You know, you see these debates about killer robots and existential threats and the like. And the real in our subtitle is not just, hey, we're pulling from the real world and we've got the end notes to prove it, but also that what's really playing out, at least in your and my lifetime, is not when do we salute the metal masters, it's how do we navigate an industrial revolution. We see a rewiring of the economy all around us, and a result, everything that pulls from the economy, you know, the politics, the society. It hits all sorts of different areas. We actually gathered, every single job automation report that we could find, you know, everything from World Bank to McKinsey, all of these different studies about what AI and automation can do to different professions. Oxford University, for example, looked at 702 different occupations and found that 47% of them are, 47% of the jobs in the US are going to face replacement or displacement or reduction over the next 20 years. And that's a high end. There's a low end estimate of 9% coming out of OECD. Whichever study you care about, 9% is still a lot. And so the point is that we already can start to feel this. We're going through a transition period. And, you know, it's hit some areas already. Factory worker, you know, you look backwards, every new robot introduced onto the assembly line has been 3.3 human workers taken off. But it's also going to hit, moving forward, all sorts of other areas. And we pulled that example of contract lawyer. Now, what's great about the fiction side of this is you got all these data, you got all these Excel spreadsheets and estimates and numbers and the like. You can play it out, though, through the experience of that character. And it weirdly becomes real in a different kind of way, because now we see, okay, what does it mean for that character to have, you know, done everything the right way, got good grades, got a good, really well-paying job, and then they lose it. And now he's doing gig work remotely from home, and it's having an effect on his marriage, on the way that he parents, but also the way he sees politically.
You describe the nature of that gig work, because I think it's very interesting and prescient, exactly what he's doing.
It's actually pulled from what we already see of, you know, sort of the combination of how Uber driver market works to the Amazon Turker market. So you have that. And again, it hits this, you know, utopian or dystopian. The concept of gig work, some people think it's awesome. You get, and it was sold as this, you know, you get the freedom to work when you want. It's a marketplace, et cetera, et cetera. The Uberization of it's going to be awesome. But then you also look and see, actually it creates a massive amount of uncertainty because it's not a consistent income. It creates sort of a hamster wheel chasing. You're always chasing after the next one. Layered into this is also something else that some of the big tech companies have done where it's gamified. And by that, I'm not saying you play video games. It's the idea that it's not just a straight wage that you get, but you get ratings and points. And then those points and ratings yield real rewards. And so you get this sort of, it's a perfectly designed system to put the person kind of on the hamster wheel where they're always chasing the next thing. And, you know, we see this in the real world, the Uber drivers who, you know, sleep in their cars. You know, it's actually not as great for the, you know, it's not better than the life of a taxi driver. It's sometimes in ways worse. But this aspect of doing it from home remotely, we're all experiencing right now, where it's not just the hamster wheel part for the you know, sort of the gig work side, it's the remote work side. And how does that affect, you know, wow, it's great to be working from home. Well, everybody who's listening to this who's working from home is starting to go, actually not. And, you know, it affects your marriage. It affects the way you parent. And so what I'm getting at is you get to see that through the experience of the character. And it makes it feel to me, and I hope the reader, more real, but also raises these kind of questions. So you get these, you know, the book has these, you know, big Hollywood scenes of, you know, stuff blowing up and, you know, really big moments, but you also have these small moments, the argument that he has with his wife that maybe hits you more.
Yeah, I would. I mean, that scene, the very first scene with them, when she comes home and she's had a bad day and needs to talk to him, but he's got VR goggles on and is essentially like grinding, being a remote assistant to elderly. And they've gamified providing comfort to the old and dying, essentially. And he's trying to get the bonus points to get the $600 for their prime for that month. And is doing Dilaudid just to kind of keep up with the stress of that lifestyle. One of my favorite moments in the book, especially early on. There's two other kind of characters that I want to hit, that I want to make sure we talk about. This is kind of, it's kind of like a classic buddy cop setup in a way. Because Keegan's the FBI agent, and I would say like one of the main plot points of the book is that she is assigned or she's kind of pressured into accepting an assignment where she is partnered with a robot for the first time in FBI history. And it is about, can a robot do an FBI agent's job, and how well, and what is it like? So tell us about Tams. If you could describe Tams physically for us, I think that's very interesting. And then kind of what they are, like how they function, because they're pretty different from other robots that you would think of in fiction, especially like robot cops.
So you hit it exactly. You've got that sort of buddy cop element to it, you know, experienced cop assigned rookie. You know, it's a, you can think of all the great movies we love out of that. Just in this case, we have, you know, what looms, which is that the partnership, and again, you know, it's not super sci-fi, but the idea that real world humans are starting to be paired up and aided by machines. So TAMS, it's short. It's everything in government is has an acronym: Tactical Autonomous Mobility System, TAMS. And TAMS is basically take the combination of what you are seeing on the physical side of robotics. So think of a lot of people probably seen the, wild YouTube videos of the Boston Dynamics, robotics, doing parkour or whatever. There's lots of different types of that. Maybe it might be a really cool hand system. Basically take that and say, okay, if that was possible in, 20, if you're thinking about some of the videos that have gone most viral in 2017, what's going to be possible? Let's move the dial 10 years forward. So on the physical side, it's a TAMS is a humanoid form robot. Yes, you've got robotic cars. Yes, you've got delivery drones, but you also will have some, because of the very nature of helping people and navigating the world, that will have a human form, two arms, two legs, a head, but it's going to reflect the way that real world robots is going. So there are subtle changes that will allow it to have greater stability when it walks, or the face. This is not a robot that you would ever figure out, that you would ever go, oh no, it's not a robot. It's, the facial expressions, it's a Japanese no mask is sort of blank so that people, put our own emotions on top of it.
She tells it to, at one point she tells it to stop. It kind of does these little, it has these little body movements it does that kind of indicate some sort of emotion or an emotionality. And she tells it to stop doing that.
Yeah. So it's doing, and this goes to the software side, which is the real part of it, is that TAMS is basically take, all the decision aids around you, whether it's your Siri, whether it's your Alexa, whether it's the ones that military now have in their operation centers. And just like the hardware, move the software, forward. And also equally the ways that are designed into that we communicate and relate to our systems. There's some of these like physical tells that they use to for us to notice. Other times it's a verbal thing. And one of the reveals, I think, more about Keegan than about TAMS, of kind of her character, as the first time she meets it and it speaks to her in a slightly female voice, like Alexa does or Siri does. And she's like, screw that. No, reprogram. And what it gets at is, one, it gives you a hint of kind of Keegan as a character. This is a rarity in the techno thriller field. It's a female character. It's the central character. If you think about a lot of the novels and movies out there, when there is a female character, they're the 1B, they're the helper to the male. And also Keegan, you mentioned that scene, like where she's outside her condo. Part of that scene is her wrestling with all of her different identities. She's got her work identity, but she's also coming from work and she's got to go home. And your home identity is your mix of, there's your spouse. And what if it's a rocky relationship, but there's also, there's your parent, you're a parent, your kid. And so kind of which game face do you put on? And what I'm getting at is that she's a really complex character. I think a more realized character, but again, she's, this moment where she's like, no, we're not going to do this bull crap of you using a female voice with me because we've got gender stereotyping, on the way that we use our mechanical servants. It gives you a hint of kind of who she is, but it also flex it, without ever going deep in it, to making you think about, hold it, the way that we, our robots communicate to us, are really about all the ways us putting our human imprinting on it. And the final thing about TAMS that's kind of neat is that you and I, and Keegan and the reader, are all thinking about it as a character, but we never actually do or say that. It's it just operates the way that, again, the robot would. It speaks the way your Siri or your Alexa does. And yet all of us, whether it's the reader to the characters in the story, to us in the real world, we can't help ourselves. And that's, again, a really interesting thing that matters in the real world too. It's just so cool to play with in a fiction sense.
I want to talk about, before we let you go, I want to hit on your antagonist.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that as the book goes on, more is revealed about their backstory. So I don't want to get too deep into it, but I do kind of want to set them up, because I think it's important. I think it's interesting. And I think it reflects problems that we're going to deal with very, very soon. What can you tell us about them, I guess, without giving away everything? I will say one of my favorite scenes early on is they have a meeting with other members of what I would call their cell, their terrorist cell, that takes place in a it's not Fortnite for obvious reasons, but it's a Fortnite style game that they are meeting in. Which I think watching the news stories lately about people having business meetings in Red Dead Redemption 2 and in conferences in Animal Crossing, like, okay, well, yeah, I mean, obvious choice. Makes sense.
It's funny because sometimes, you know, when you do these briefs for, you know, whatever intelligence community, real world said, they're like, you know, could that actually happen? And you're like, not only can it happen, it's already happened.
It happened yesterday.
Yeah. Well, and not just, you know, the joke of, you know, what you were saying, like the business meetings, we've seen ISIS do similar on the video gaming platform mm-hmm. side. So without revealing too much, we have a dastardly bad guy, as every story actually has to have. A couple of things I hope, like the hero character, that are a little bit different about them is that first, the ideology, what's motivating them, it's not the villain who, you know, pulls at their mustache. It's actually an ideology that I think a lot of people might find, might understand in a certain way. Sort of the sense that the world is moving too fast around us, and a little bit of what we were just talking about, of like what you're saying is utopian, that's actually dystopian, and we need to stop it. The second thing is, you know, I will reveal this because I think it reflects another sort of real world lesson, is that, you know, as you said, there's a cell, there's a meeting in this place, but it's also about the people that are coming together, that it's a strange kind of coalition where mm-hmm. there are groups that have seemingly wildly different beliefs, but yet they're all kind of coming together because they all are sort of against the same thing. And oh, by the way, we've seen, you know, real world examples of that literally right now in the middle of the, you know, look at the protests that happened in Huntington Beach in California. You had surfers and far-right extremists and anti-vaxxers and vegans, all gathering, you know, totally different ideologies, but all gathering because they were sort of angry about the same thing. The final thing, though, that stands out about our bad guy, and again, going back to this pulling from the real world side, but I think giving it greater thrills and chills for the fiction side, is that they're a new kind of, I'll say, terrorist, because they have powers created by the change in the internet to the Internet of Things. So they are able to carry out attacks that wouldn't have been possible in the past, but are increasingly possible now. And it might be individual level crimes, killing someone in their smart home, never stepping inside the smart home. Or it might be something at scale. I'll plot spoil a little bit here. Maybe someone recreating versions of the biblical 10 plagues, but through cyber means. Wow, that could never happen. Well, I got the end notes to show it. I think it gives, you know, hopefully the scale, the interest. But, you know, one of the differences of, I go back to that notion of useful fiction, is that, you know, for some people, it's going to be the entertainment. The useful side for some parts might be predictive. Oh man, that's coming. That's cool. I need to understand it. In other ways, it might be preventative. That's a nightmare scenario. Okay, here's what we can do to make sure that doesn't come true.
Would you say it's fair to call them a neo-Luddite, with the caveat that we have a poor understanding of that historical movement?
Absolutely.
The term has come to mean something that it doesn't quite reflect the reality.
Yeah, and I think it actually goes back to this notion of going through an industrial revolution.
Right.
When you get massive change, you get economic winners and losers. You know, the last industrial revolution had winners on the and losers on the individual level, on regional level. Different industries did better or worse. Even different nations did better and worse. And then that ripples out to affect everything from what industry looks like to it changes politics. And again, you get good and bad things. I need to be 100% clear about this. The last industrial revolution, you get political movements like no industrial revolution. There's no such thing as children's rights. There's no such thing as women's rights. There's no such thing as workers' rights. There's certain holidays. There's no Labor Day, right?
Yeah, but a whole lot of people had to get their hands mangled in looms for all of that stuff.
Bingo. So you get that. You get the bad side too, right? You get displacement, people out of work. You get other ideologies that are maybe not so good, not just maybe. You get communism and fascism coming out of the Industrial Revolution. And we spend the next 100 years kind of working its way out. So similar kind of trend we can feel around us. We can feel good and bad aspects coming out of it. We can feel sort of rifts on the old politics. And one of the things that you mentioned the Luddites. The Luddites were actually... we would now call them a terrorist movement or an insurgency. They were mostly the sort of craftsmen who had been put out of work by the very first factories in England. And so they tried to stop the future by, they would assassinate factory owners. They would go in and smash up the early factories. They would hold these marches that would turn into pitched street battles. And the scale of it was such, it sort of puts us Americans in our place. In 1814, more of the British army was deployed to put down the Luddites than was deployed to fight the American army in the War of 1812. So when they were doing their strategic calculus of where do we send our troops, they said Luddites are a bigger problem than those Americans are. And so, I think we can again, looking forward, say, okay, we're starting to see, strange groups come together, mostly just in their anger. We're starting to see people who are saying maybe the future is moving too fast. But also a little bit like, the way bin Laden wanted to take us back to the 600s, but he wore a Timex and he used, a 747.
Crossing on his saved on his GameCube.
Yeah. The same thing, the people who may want to fight the future are actually going to be using all of these tools that are out there for all of us as well. I don't have to use the fiction of the book. Drones have been used by governments. They've been used by police. They've also been used by criminals to drug smuggle. They've been used by terrorist groups to carry out their own drone strikes. So again, every technology has a good and bad side. What we do is say, okay, let's move the dial forward. Let's play that out, but play it out, not in a galaxy far, far away, not in a future, 100 years from now. Let's play it out and what lies just when we, open that next door.
Tell me about some of the research you did around cybersecurity.
One of the fun things is what we discovered, the vulnerabilities in the DC systems, they're real.
Oh, yeah.
The research for the book unveiled all of this amazing, not just what was possible in cyber threats, but just layers of cybersecurity vulnerabilities that boggle the mind. And by that, I mean, there's some stuff that, and people working in cybersecurity, there's reports where you will reveal a certain vulnerability. And we play with those in the book. It might be vulnerabilities in water treatment systems or transportation networks. And so sometimes it's from a vulnerability report. Other times it's what someone shown off at a hacker convention. Other times it might be a certain kind of hack that's already happened just somewhere else. So one of the things that in the story happens in Washington, D.C., actually recently happened to Israeli water treatment systems in the real world. But there's also what happens when you talk to people and the stuff that they tell you, you know, over beers or whatnot that they wouldn't publish. And one of the scariest, kind of funniest moments for me was interviewing someone who worked on Washington, D.C. Water systems. And he talked about how there were, in particular, four, we'll call them valves, that would, if you could flip them, that you could flood major parts of the city and its infrastructure. And his wife was actually there in the background, and she yells out, "You don't know him all that well. Don't tell him which four." So we don't have, of course, which four in the story of the light, but it's sort of this funny moment of just, you know, the behind the scenes of the research, but also just, wow, oh my goodness, we got to fix that.
I don't even know what to say to that. I think that's a good spot to end, Peter Singer. Thank you for coming on to Cyber. The book is Burn In, a novel of the real robotic revolution.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Jason, we have a guest this week.
Yeah. Gita, hi.
Hi, I'm here. My name's Gita.
Gita, welcome to Cypher, the roundup version of our show Cyber, where you're gonna tell us about your amazing work in the last few weeks.
Yeah, so Gita Jackson, who are you?
I'm Gita Jackson. I'm staff writer at Motherboard and also for Vice Gaming. I sort of straddle the two sections. I used to work at Kotaku, and then I applied for a job here, and I got it. Now I work here, and I couldn't be happier.
Yeah, we love to have you here.
Is it Canadian of me to say that I called it Kotaku?
It is a little bit. It's the a sound. Americans, unless they're from specific parts of New England, don't really say that. Or very, you know, parts of America that are really, really close, like kissing the border. I think in Buffalo, the a sound is more common.
Right. You should have heard me like 5 years ago. My Canadian accent was even thicker.
It's amazing how much Degrassi I've watched that I can identify this so quickly, you know?
Cyber is now a linguistics podcast. I'm into it.
So Gita, a lot of people were telling me about this story who weren't necessarily in the Vice universe, or don't normally read Vice, but they were telling me how this story was just such a perfect embodiment of what's going on today. And I loved it because it sort of made me rethink about past periods of history that look cool and sound cool, but in fact are extremely hard and very difficult to go through and you know, important. Anyways, I want to hear from you. Tell me about this story you wrote.
So the cool zone comes from this tweet from this guy named Shanar Moorhead, who is a really, really kind person, actually. After the article went up, we ended up talking to each other. I didn't reach out to him for comment because the tweet has like multiple thousands of retweets. It turns out like his relationship to that tweet is like a little bit, I don't know, he's not sure about it really. But because the calling something cool that is so terrifying to live through and like very violent and has like actual human life and death in the balance can feel flippant. But what I was trying to express in the article is that these moments where the world seems like it's in such a moment of upheaval and there's no historical model to follow to understand how things might shake out, That means anything is possible, not just the bad stuff anymore. We've seen some actual real gains. Like the NYPD, like, dissolved their plainclothes cops unit, which is means, I mean, it's not a huge gain, but that feels incredible to me. And that is the kind of thing that is only possible in the cool zone.
Can you name some, like, other potential periods of history that are the cool zone, just for reference for people who are not super sure what the cool zone is?
Yeah. So, I used to read about punk rockers in 77 living in New York and think about, oh, I'd love to live there at that time. That would be so cool. Probably not. Probably the 70s New York was actually very dangerous and not fun to live in. That's a cool zone. That's a classic cool zone. And those people making those music, they were really, really poor and discriminated against and very angry and living through a political time that was really, like, subjugating marginalized people quite a bit. As much as fun it is to think about, oh, get in the van and, like, the DC hardcore scene, you wouldn't have wanted to live through that cool zone. That wouldn't have been very cool. Even further back, I know a lot of people in my high school all got really obsessed with the French Revolution, thinking it was so cool to read about. Very, very cool to read about. They beheaded people, you know? They chopped people's heads off.
Totally. I was thinking about that. I'm like, I remember how I used to think the French Revolution was cool. And then I remember I read a first-person account of, like, what they actually did to Marie Antoinette's head. And I was like, huh.
Yeah.
I think,
not that chill.
I think I'm good. I think I'm good with never going back to that point in history.
Yeah, I mean, I used to think my dad grew up in Selma, Alabama, in the during the Civil Rights Movement. He was a teenager. And I used to think about what he did and how he acted with such admiration. And now I'm, like, in a very similar situation. And I understand that it comes from a place of necessity and a little bit of a place of fear. But because it's all so intense and it's all happening at once and it seems like the momentum is inevitable, it also feels like if I just take these steps, if I keep pushing, I can actually achieve the thing that I want to achieve. Unlike most periods of human history where, like, most marginalized people, you know, Black people, poor people, LGBTQ people, they're just grounded to the dirt forever.
Right. Yes.
And it's like, you know, obviously the first civil rights movement, very not cool to live through, but, you know, major gains there for Black people in America. And also, there's, like, a lot of movies made about that period. Like, you don't see people making movies about, like, I don't know, boring shit.
Yeah.
I can't even think of it because
unless
it's like...
Unless you're Noah Baumbach, but I'm...
Ooh.
Yeah. Ooh. Actually, I really like Noah Baumbach. I was just...
Shots
was
fired. Not a fan of Marriage Story, I hear.
I like earlier Noah Baumbach movies, but... Actually, my one friend, Patrick Willems, he does this, he has a really good, like, the only good film analysis YouTube channel, in that he went to college with me in my same department, so I know he's smart. But he has a great, very funny video that is, what if a Spider-Man movie was directed by Noah Baumbach? And it is the Spider-Man movie I've wanted ever since I've seen that. Like, it's so good.
I just thought of, like, several really, really bizarre fight scenes where, like, no one actually hurts each other or has the talent to do so.
Absolutely. They're all just clumsily punching walls.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I feel like Adam Driver could throw a punch, though.
He was in the military, right? He was a Marine.
Yeah, he's a pretty, like, I remember seeing him on, like, Girls. I was like, you're kind of jacked, man. I don't want to fuck with
you. He's a very big boy. I wouldn't want to fuck with him.
there's been think pieces on this. Think pieces. In scare quotes. He's like, very big for, like, Hollywood. Like, he's 6'1".
That's true.
That's not exactly, like, a giant.
Yeah. Yeah, he's taller than most actors, which I suppose is an advantage here. But I just keep remembering the scene in The Last Jedi where he takes his shirt off and it's just, like, the broadside of a ship. Like, he's such a broad person.
Yeah, yeah.
It's incredible. I also wrote other articles that were not
about
you
did.
Adam.
So,
we're
not about shirtless Adam Driver. It's not about shirtless Adam Driver.
Yeah,
I love we're transitioning from shirtless Adam Driver to something way more serious. I also loved this story. I kind of felt like it was a bit of a hit list in a great way, like a good way, because it's about which racist monuments are around America, and you can find them on a map.
Who's next? Emmanuel pointed this out to me. My parents actually donate to the Southern Poverty Law Center, but they upkeep a user-submitted mostly map, or at least they have a form where people can update or add monuments. Say if there's a monument near you that is a Confederate monument that needs to be taken down, or just that you want people to know about at all, you know? Or maybe some of them have been taken down and the map's not updated yet. It also seems like a really good idea if you visit their website and check out their Who's Heritage map to it shows you all the Confederate monuments that have existed in the United States. So it includes ones that have been already been taken down. Like, did you know that in 1957, there was a bust of Stonewall Jackson in the Bronx that was put up by the United Daughters of the Confederacy?
Wow.
1957 in the Bronx. It seems like an insane thing to do.
I wonder why they did that. I wonder why the Daughters of the Confederacy put that up.
In that neighborhood at that time.
Yeah, it's a real, like...
head scratcher.
Real
shocker. But there's real a lot shocker. Of statues like that that are still up that were, you know, a lot of the Confederate monuments in the United States, they were either added during the first rise of the KKK in the early 1900s, or they were added during the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement explicitly to intimidate Black people into not protesting and fighting for their rights.
Well, this is the interesting thing about it is, like, people think that they were around from, like, 1870 or something. It's like, no. These came back, like, in a spat. And also, another thing to remember is these monuments came back periods in which the KKK had a resurgence. Mm-hmm. Every single time. Mm-hmm. So you had, like, right around World War I, right after World War I, that entire period, tons of Confederate monuments start shooting up. Yeah. Same thing again during the Civil Rights Movement.
You can really, really see that when you look at this map, because it shows you the dates that they've been dedicated, when they know it, and who has dedicated them. And they're almost always these, like, groups that have made it a part of their political goals to make sure that the Confederacy remains a physical reminder in like the American consciousness. And, like, a lot of these statues, if you look at these maps, a lot of them are in Black neighborhoods, are places where Black people would see them. And there's only one reason why you would put a bust of Stonewall Jackson in a majority Black neighborhood. And it's to remind people, Black people, that they were once slaves. And that's it. So right now, a lot of protesters in the ongoing protest against police brutality in memory of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Tony McDade, just a list of names that keeps growing. They have been removing these statues, beheading them, defacing them. And, well, it just seems like the Southern Poverty Law Center has given everyone a wonderful resource for finding the historically inaccurate statues that are in their town.
And doing whatever you want like to them. Do with them.
And doing whatever you want to do with them. And you know what? The other thing, too, is I report on the far right, and these statues are very important to the neo-Nazis, to the white power folks, because they love to take pictures with them. Yeah. They really do. And I think, like, that tells you everything you need to know about why they need to go.
I completely agree. You know, all they are for is for in reinforcing a racial hegemony that has existed for a really long time that we are now fighting to finally upend. Hopefully we'll make some real progress.
Yeah. One thing that I found, I mean, I guess I wasn't surprised by this. Like, you know, a lot of the monuments and roads and parks, etc., that are named after Confederate generals or Confederate people or KKK members or what have you are in the South and the Southeast. But then you have, like, the Confederate Memorial Fountain in Helena, Montana, and, like, all these monuments that are in things that, like, weren't even states during the Civil War, and especially, like, Northwestern states, which I know obviously there's a history of racism that pervades the entire country and certainly wasn't limited and isn't limited to Southern states. But it's like the Confederacy, a failed fucking JV team, certainly has, like, a lot more memorials than a lot of other losing squads, I must say. people who, in theory, shouldn't have any skin in the game, like our dear friends in, I don't know, like the Canadian border in Washington.
There's a smattering of them in like rural places in California. And it's like, I know that California isn't just the coastal towns, but y'all were Mexico at that time.
I also like, gotta be clear too. Like Italians, I'm Italian. We got Christopher Columbus statues all over the place. I don't understand why we're so big on this guy. He was a complete genocidier and piece of shit.
He was a big time dumbass who thought he was in India and like didn't listen to anyone who was like, "Yo, dog, we've never heard of that place."
And like clearly a deeply racist and troubling figure in history. And you know, like his statues like are getting it.
The idea of discovering a continent where people are clearly already living is like one that's been, we've been hashed that one out. I feel like we can admit that these statues don't have any place in the United States, and that the only reason why they're there is to subjugate the indigenous people who live there.
Right. He has been going swimming a lot recently at the bottom of creeks, oceans, ports, etc., which is good.
Maybe he's trying to get home. I hope he finds that.
I saw
transatlantic.
One of the best tweets I've seen in recent weeks was Columbus going to go into the ocean and say he discovered Atlantis.
Actually, our own Lorenzo Lozo tweeted something so good yesterday that was just like, as an Italian that was raised in Spain, I just want to say I think Christopher Columbus is super fucking dumb.
Yep.
God.
Yep. Yeah.
I grew up in a town with a large Italian immigrant population. Like there's a Sicilian church in our town that was an identical copy of one in Sicily, so exact that when the one in Sicily burned down, they asked for the blueprints of the one from my hometown because they were exactly the same, and that was the only way they could figure out how to rebuild it. And yeah, you know, the Christopher Columbus shit. He's not even like a part of Italian culture that the Italians seem to care very much about. Like, it doesn't make any sense that these statues are still here. And yet.
No, it was actually the reason that they're around is because it was a way for Italians to try to weave themselves into American history and stop being discriminated against, is really what it is.
Yeah.
So they're like, see, Christopher Columbus, we've been here since the beginning. We have a stake in this. Right, guys? Right.
Yeah.
So then, of course, you have like the rise of the Italian community and actual, you had not just the mafia, but a rise in wealth. They were like, they created Christopher Columbus foundations and societies. And they were like, well, we're going to put these statues everywhere. So everyone knows, you know, Italians have something to do with this.
The creation of whiteness is so interesting.
Oh, yeah. Like, I mean, like, like Italians say, like, we call white people manja cakes. And Gita, you've seen me before.
Yeah.
I'm white.
Yeah. I remember, the immigrant population in my hometown, it was majority Italian with a strong Polish minority. And I remember we were doing a standardized test, and this guy named Paul, he was like, yo, miss, because that was what we called teachers in our school. It was just, yo, mister, or yo, miss. Yo, miss, what do I put down for my ethnicity on the standardized test? And she was like, Paul, you put white. He was like, no, but I'm Polish. Why would I put white? And it's just, you really, like, understand, though, like, when you are in those environments, like, white is something that people made up.
Oh, yeah. 100%. Yeah. Or like, what's white enough? What isn't white? I mean, it's just, it's almost as if this whole thing is really stupid.
It's almost, as if it's, if you put on your They Live sunglasses, you're just going to see it be racist when you look at these statues. Yeah.
It's really interesting how racism is completely illogical. Yeah. All right. So this, another story, final story that you did, you were on fire the last few weeks. Jeez.
Yeah.
Headline being, Black people are always the side story. I'm just going to let you explain from there.
Can we shout out Waypoint Radio here? Because Gita is a regular participant on Waypoint Radio, which is our video games podcast, and she's excellent on it. So if you enjoy the conversation that's about to follow, go listen to that show as well.
Yeah, so video games are the other thing that I report on, because I reported on them quite a bit when I was at Kotaku, a video game website. And this week there, this week is supposed to be like the end of E3, which is video games' biggest United States based sort of tech conference on video games. And this is a particularly important year because both Microsoft and Sony have unveiled their new consoles. And this was, so Sony was having, in lieu of a huge blowout presser, they had a, what's it called? Just a lame live stream. It's a really boring live
Zoom
stream.
Chat.
They basically had a Zoom chat.
They did what we're doing right now.
It would be cool. Honestly, it would be much cooler if they were doing what we're doing right now. Like, it was really, when you watch the Sony presser and like compare it to a Nintendo Direct, you can see how difficult it is actually to get those things together and have them be interesting, and how good Nintendo is at making those things and like really like important, like short and to the point. I came away from that presser not really understanding why I should buy a PS5, which is not good, I would say. The whole point of those things is to make you want to buy it. The only thing they really showed off were the games. And like, I understand I'm more excited about a console when the games are really good, but they started off with a teaser trailer for a game called Spider-Man Miles Morales. And if you are one of the many people that saw the Oscar-winning movie Into the Spider-Verse, you know who Miles Morales is. He's Black Spider-Man. He's a kid from Brooklyn who was bitten by a radioactive spider, and he is actually Spider-Man, the Spider-Man in most of the Marvel comics now. There are Peter Parker books still, but they have to be like labeled that they are Peter Parker books. Miles Morales is Spider-Man. The only place where he really isn't Spider-Man is in the movies, which I don't know why that would be. That's weird. It's a weird thing. Anyway, I was so psyched. Like, I was really psyched. I really liked Insomniac's Spider-Man game. I like Peter Parker. I like Spider-Man a lot. Other than the X-Men, I think he's my favorite, like, Marvel property. Just because, I mean, he's hashtag relatable, right? I also was a lonely, nerdy kid that wished I had superpowers in high school. So, I mean, I get it. I get why people like Peter Parker. But
Huge Wolverine fan, by the way, full disclosure.
I can only remember Peter Parker as Tobey Maguire, and he was such an annoying Spider-Man to me.
I mean, Tobey Maguire is just, whenever I think of Tobey Maguire, I just think of Cider House Rules, and I want to blow my own fucking head off.
Oh, boy.
God. Yeah, I mean, I like those movies because I like Sam Raimi, and I think Spider-Man 2 is still one of the better superhero movies because it is very human in a way that I think most Marvel movies are not interested in humanity. As corny as it is, the Sam Raimi moments where he's trying to do, if you mess with one of us, you'll mess with all of us. The moment in Spider-Man 2 where he's attacked by Doc Ock and he goes unconscious in that subway train because he's trying to stop it, and he uses all his strength up and his mask rips, and then people on the subway train look at him, and one of them says, I have a son this age. Like, that is not really a moment you'd get in superhero movies broadly. I think Sam Raimi cares about that shit. I don't think Marvel as an entity, Disney as an entity, actually does. Any more of my thoughts about superhero comics, then don't ever at me on Twitter.com. but yeah, Spider-Man Miles Morales was exciting to me because I wanted to play as Miles since I saw him in that Insomniac Spider-Man game. He's a character in that game. You can play as him for a section. It seemed like they were gearing up for a sequel where you're just Miles Morales. I found out my good friend Evan Narcisse would be writing for it. I got even more excited. And then on the Waypoint Radio podcast, Patrick Klepek was like, so that release date seems a little soon for a full-on sequel. And I was like, oh, shit. So in video games, there's been this weird trend where these large studios, what are called AAA studios, will put out a version of their major franchises that stars a woman, a non-white person, like someone else other than the normal straight white male protagonist. But it'll be a shorter side story that doesn't get as big of a marketing push. And it's just like, this is the third time now that this has happened. In the morning when I woke up after the conference, just thinking, dreading hearing it, the first thing I saw was like, yes, Spider-Man Miles Morales is a shorter, like, standalone side story. And it's just like, Black people love video games. The Black people kept the PS Vita and PSP markets alive. Like, there was a period of time where you'd go, I lived in Hyde Park in Chicago, and in the one bus that takes you from the South Side to downtown Chicago, because Chicago's a normal place, you'd always just see all these Black teenagers, like, playing GTA on their PS Vita, like, every day. And I...
yeah, like, I mean, like, it's like everyone likes video games, you know?
Yeah. You know, Black people, every single Black man I've known has played Battlefield and had an Xbox 360. Like, mm-hmm. People fucking love video games. I don't understand why it seems like an impossibility or a risk to have Miles Morales in a game that is the same length and scale as Insomniac's original Spider-Man game, which wasn't a very long game. It was about 30 hours. Shorter if you are like a big time gamer, but Miles deserves that. Like, they explicitly they compared the scope of this project to something called Lost Legacy, which Uncharted is a very big franchise, and Lost Legacy was like a 10-hour side game. And it's like, I don't want to spend just a third of the time in Miles Morales' shoes. I want to be that kid.
Except, you know, they'll still like pour millions and millions of dollars into like another epic where Assassin's Creed has some like historical white dude going around killing everybody. You know, this, yeah. The latest one is some Viking. Like, give me a fucking break.
Yeah, I mean, and the Ass Creed really makes me bonkers because there's so many periods of like history that would be so interesting that they just aren't going to, because there's no way that white people could be there.
Yeah, like, exactly. You
know, everybody in the world wants Samurai Assassin's Creed. Not gonna happen though. Like,
yeah, like what the hell? And when I saw that latest Assassin's Creed with Vikings in it, I was just like, fucking perfect, great. I can't wait for all the neo-Nazis to just like,
yeah,
have boners,
yeah,
to this.
They love that iconography.
Come on, man. Yeah, like,
and it's too many times for me. Like, Assassin's Creed is actually a franchise who has done this exact thing. Like, Assassin's Creed 4, you did play as a non-white protagonist, but he was mixed with white, which was a clever way for these developers to still give you a white guy. And no, that was 3. 3 was the American Revolution, the one that no one liked except my old boss, Stephen Totillo, for some reason loved it. 4 was the pirate one, which, again, it's great. And they had non-white characters on those pirate ships because, obviously, historically speaking, there were non-white people on pirate ships. But they also, you know, they had a side game starring one of those characters, a Black man, a freed slave, where you went around and freed slaves.
It really feels just a DLC. Yeah. And I mean, it really feels like with Miles Morales and with the Assassin's Creed game and with the Uncharted game, it's like, well, we're like trying out like having a Black protagonist, like, we're experimenting with it. Like, we don't want to put, you know, our full budget, our full development power behind, you know, a full sequel or a new IP, God forbid, like,
yeah,
a brand new.
Let's just be really soft on this, like, these people of color getting their own games. You know what I mean? Like, it's just, yeah, like, what?
It's like testing the waters where it's like, why? I mean, why? There's no need. Like, yeah, like you said, Black people love video games.
So,
like, Black Panther,
popular.
Like,
you know.
And also, I would say too, like, I can't speak for everyone, but I feel like nobody would give a shit. Many white people would play those games too. Like, it's not as if,
yeah,
like, I mean,
I feel like,
look at the movie Black Panther. Many people have watched it. It's not as if I watch like superhero movies and I have to see like a white guy doing it.
Yeah.
Like,
you're,
yeah,
hearing more and more that people enjoyed the film Black Panther.
Yeah, exactly. Like,
everyone's saying it, but no one's talking about it.
Yeah.
I feel like by doing this kind of thing where it's clear that they're testing the waters and seeing how it would sell, what you're doing is admitting that you think having a Black protagonist is a risk. And that says a lot more about the video game industry than anything else about these games. If you're worried about pissing off a part of your consumer base by having a Black man character, you're a fucking pussy.
Yeah, seriously.
All I gotta say.
and like, again, like, you really think that it's gonna, like, destroy your sales or something? Like, I feel like it's like not going to do that.
It's like not even destroyer sales. Like the amount of abuse that video game developers take is on par or worse with the abuse that like video game journalists take. I have talked to video game developers that have had people dox them and find their home addresses for things as minor as Seamus Blackwell, who did the Jurassic Park game Trespasser that was universally despised because it was unfinished. He told me an article I wrote about that. He was like lead designer on that game when he was 25. So you can see why it didn't really work out. So I wanted to ask him about leading a project that big at that age and what you learned from it. And he said, like, yeah, I mean, when that happened, it was early days of the internet. But like he got death threats. He got people finding out his home address, you know, weird shit in the mail. That happens. But I feel like if you're afraid of that, you have a bigger fucking problem than like putting out a game with a black protagonist. It just is like decades of cowardice, just decades and decades of cowardice compounding on top of each other. When we're at this point where you have to apologize for having a girl on the box or putting a game out with a non-white main character.
Yep. And it's just I also just feel like it's a risk that they shouldn't be afraid of. You know, like it's just stupid. Yeah. It's just totally stupid.
When and faced with what actual marginalized people face in the world.
Yeah, exactly.
Shut the fuck up.
And also, like, this kind of thing, like, representation like that is far more important than, like, than anything else.
And it's also clear that when these developers make this decision, it's an indication that there are not very many people of color working in that studio, or at least not many people of color working at that studio that are involved in the higher-level decision-making process. I feel like any black person that works in games knows for sure that black people are going to eat up Spider-Man Miles Morales. That's black people food. No, like, we're going to love that shit. It's in the Arizona iced tea of video games. And any, if there was like a black person in a C-suite part of that company or in the higher levels of the game design development process high enough where they could put their foot down and be like, no, this one's a full-on sequel. We'll do a different thing for the side game. The decision would be made. But it's not. So you know what the inside of that company looks like a little bit now.
Yep. I think, I mean, that's those are all extremely important because this is how these sorts of, you know, not just in gaming, these are these sorts of generational issues with many of the industries we're all involved in continue to persist.
Yeah. Yeah. I am sitting next to an award I got from AfroDev, which is a like a sort of a black person networking, and you know, they give awards for people, black people in game development who have contributed to the culture in some way. I got their award for media in 2019, and sitting next to me on this award is coolest thing I own is an original cartridge from Jerry Lawson, who was the inventor of the cartridge. He's a black man. We've been here since the very beginning. It just is bizarre that we are represented so poorly.
Well, that's an amazing way to end this, actually. Well, first off, congrats. That's an awesome award.
Thanks. It's so fucking cool. I never thought really I'd have one of these.
That's really fucking cool, yeah.
We love awards.
Yeah. I love it. Hell yeah to awards, too.
Shout out to awards when we win them.
Yes. Hell yeah to awards when we win
when
them.
When we don't win them, we don't awards. Care. And sometimes don't dislike them.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's accurate. Yeah.
Well, you know, we have to have you back on again.
That would be super fun.
This has been a very interesting and amazing and fun cipher.
It has been. Well, thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming. Thanks and for Jason. Coming.
Yes, what?
Thanks for coming.
Yeah, I'm always
thanks
here.
Thanks for coming too.
All right. Goodbye.
Bye. Bye.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.